I'm Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Coffee Cup Cantos. Two Eyes Standing. An Irishman I once worked with used to entertain me every Monday morning as we sorted mail side by side. The source of mirth was his descriptions of all the socializing he and his family had done that weekend. He invariably referred to the other parties as our friends. After too many Mondays, I could endure no more. I've been married 3 times. Let me point out something. Your friends are those friends of yours that your wife approves of, and the sum total of all her friends since birth. He looked at me hard while he processed this information, and then his face softened like a boy who had just succeeded in catching an elusive frog. Then he grinned. You're absolutely right. Now, that's according to nature, and in my opinion, it is wisdom. Who better to protect the nest from all perils but the intuitive mother of the offspring? Next Monday, I was again regaled with tales from the ski slopes, but this time the protagonists were referred to as my wife's friends. It got me thinking that it had taken me until west of the halfway mark of my life to fill up one hand's worth of friends, and then they had begun to pass away. It's different with women, and some women could fill up both hands and both feet. Wives are not infallible, and once in a while it's the husband who must quarantine those who don't cast a shadow. There have been 3 occasions in my married life where I disregarded the intuitive censoring of friends. In 2 instances, I ignored loud internal alarms and deferred to what I thought to at the time was a noble overriding of my own innate common sense for the sake of my spouse. The first instance led me to a complete disaster, but that's a tale for another day. The second instance is very recent by comparison and less intense. They say, better late than never, and I've found that to be the usual case. The situation I speak of occurred in the early days of my current marriage. As I was being introduced to my wife's friends, there was one lady I did not take to. It was just an inchoate feeling at the time, so I did the manly thing and I ignored it for the sake of not having to have a powwow with my new wife about one of her friends. In a short while, the woman married a man with many problems. I privately predicted what the next 20-odd years would bring in that marriage. During those 2 decades, I had the awful discomfort of watching my prediction unfurl in real time. She had 2 children, and I had a child with my new wife, in addition to a child from a previous marriage. I attended a cycle of reciprocal birthdays, various feasts, and celebrations. Between these planned events, I can recall only 1 single outing of the 2 families, and it went badly. I had nothing in common with the husband, and I hated to watch him spiraling downwards. I felt sorry for his children and annoyed at his wife for creating an unhappy family by choosing this type of man. In daily speech, these people would be referred to as friends. There were 2 decades of phone calls to my wife for either of 2 purposes. One was to brag about any financial gains enjoyed by the woman, and the other was to complain about her miserable marriage. All those hours took away my wife's ear, and it's fortunate for us that I am a writer and a reader. The husband eventually died from substance abuse, and the children grew up. There wasn't much contact except for phone calls to brag about various money-making schemes and invitations to newer, bigger houses as she traded up. About 1 year ago, I saw her at a party. It was the first time in quite a while. My wife and I were introduced to the new boyfriend of the widow. They had been seeing each other for 7 years. The guy raced across the floor before we were in the door and started pumping my hand. Though I'd never laid eyes on him, I had my 3rd intuitive warning. There are always crazy people at parties, which is why I rarely attend them. Evidently, the widow had been talking about us to the man for 1 year. It turned out they were both following the Seventh-day Adventist sect. It was at an SDA church that they had met. This was new information. Over all the years of our acquaintance, I had never asked the woman which church she attended. The party was over in 1 hour, and all the attendees were past 50 years old. The woman increased the frequency of her phone calls to my house and talked a lot about her boyfriend. One night it was all good and future plans, and the next day it was a laundry list of wrongs he had done to her. One day, about half a year ago, my wife and I were entertaining some new neighbors at our retirement residence in a small town about 200 miles upriver from Vancouver. As we sat at the kitchen table chatting, a truck pulled up. It was the widow and her beau. What came next was bizarre. It was told to us assembled that God had spoken to the woman and had guided the pair to our little town where the fellow had just attempted to purchase a house with money from the sale of his ailing mother's house. I was too shocked to react and I went out on the porch to have a smoke, where I was joined by the SDA man. He was a tall, pale-eyed Métis. He couldn't string three words together without using the ligatures Lord and Jesus. His voice had been ravaged by drug and alcohol, and he had the timbre of a rusty hinge on an outhouse door. Still processing the facts that a total stranger and a person I did not care for had followed me to a place that I had picked at random 4 years prior and had attempted to purchase a house, I tried to make conversation. The fellow, by way of acknowledging my surprise, assured me that he had nothing to do with these happenings. He claimed that they had not known the day before that the Lord would lead them thither, and he further assured me that his gal was the one who had had the divine inspirations. The Lord is always working, Michael. There's a reason for everything. The devil is too, I replied. Rust never sleeps. I rolled a smoke and mentioned a place nearby where Tlatlan people had fished consistently since before the pyramids of Egypt were constructed. It was an attempt to guide the conversation towards things mundane. The earth is only 6,000 years old, my pastor told me. My initial thought was to grab him by the belt buckle and throat and toss him off the porch. I looked through the door, saw all the ladies talking, and I quelled that impulse. I continued to talk and disagree with his pastor's timeline. The man's voice went up, as did mine. The widow came to the door of the porch when our voices had reached a sustained shout. Her face had a horrible worried look, and the lines it created on her countenance were already well-worn past. Soon the couple were successful in buying a house in the town. My wife and I were invited to the blessing of this house, which coincided with our next trip up from Vancouver. The day arrived and we were all on time. When we got inside, there was one other couple we had never met, and a Hungarian pastor who did a circuit of SDA churches in the BC cattle country. The man of the house was in bed, laid low from something he had eaten. I sat in the kitchen and had a wonderful conversation with the Hungarian, who had read many of the same books as I had and was very conscious of how the world really works. He seemed refreshed by my own knowledge, and he refrained from giving me any sermons. The Métis arose and we all held hands while the Hungarian mumbled a bored blessing by rote. Just before the pastor left for his long drive home, he admonished the host to use his Métis credentials to bring as many Tlatlan into his sheep pen as possible. I wondered at the chances of success of this. The Tlatlan people were well aware of the work of archaeologists on their own local sites. These sites predated the SDA beginning of the world. When I mentioned this glitch later, I was politely told that Satan had cleverly scattered old bones and pots just to mislead the scientists. The widow had learned that I intended to pursue hunting and fishing in my retirement. Since these were two things her Métis knew, she used this as a bridge between the two of us men. I was able to focus on recognition of those skills instead of his annoying, raspy voice. His knowledge on these two topics earned him a degree of respect. I decided to try to make the best of kamikaze neighbors. Perhaps we could fish and hunt together in peace and otherwise live separate lives. Later, I learned that the woman had decided to live nearby so she would have a safe place to go and sympathetic ears to listen to her latest self-induced problems. She was willing to continue as a helpless victim as long as other people could hear the complaints. These type of people usually pray aloud eloquently at the drop of a hat and never miss a day of church. After the Métis moved in, I went fishing with him. He talked of hunting and Jesus, and fishing and Jesus, and substance abuse and Jesus, and his fiancée and Jesus. I tried to learn something about river fishing. He gave me the fishing vest of his recently deceased father and taught me a knot for attaching hooks to a salmon rod. I gave him the DVD of a movie we had watched at my place. It was a true story about a Cherokee boy who learns the hard way about Christian charity. He gave me the salmon rod that had belonged to his dead father. I gave him an antique Belgian wardrobe. He gave me an old coat rack from a church. I gave him a copy of my Chicory CD. I got a 3-hour phone call from this man complaining about the woman. She was a suicidal, fickle Jezebel, according to him. My wife received multiple calls from the woman complaining about the man. He was a selfish, manipulative, control freak, according to her. We decided not to take sides. They had the Lord to guide their affair. Hunting season was looming, and I was busy. I decided that a sober hunting partner would be good to start out with. I didn't consider the difference between a non-drinker and a reformed drinker. I took the CORE program, passed, and purchased a beautiful Finnish rifle. I took a first aid course. My partner in this course was a boy who happened to be named Nimrod. After successfully treating the staged collapse of the mighty Mesopotamian hunter, I passed the lifesaver qualification. When I had time, I went to my new little town and I joined the firing range. The Metis and I went together to sight in my new rifle. He was gifted in this, and within 3 shots, we had my gun zeroed in at 100 yards. I tried standing, crouching, sandbagging, left-handed, right-handed, with one eye open, and with two. At the end of these experiments, I learned that I shot best standing with both eyes open using my left shoulder. In this way, I was able to place 50% of my shots in the vital area of a deer at 100 yards on the first day. A Chinese salesman at the gun shop had taught me about the two eyes and had encouraged me to shoot left. When using one eye, a person lost the big picture and could not follow a moving target. I shot 40 rounds that week, 3 days with the Metis spotting for me, and on the last day I went alone. Each day the border of the range was visited by big, fat mule deers that appeared immune to the racket. Every morning one or two eagles cruised back and forth several thousand feet above and screamed repeatedly. On the last day at the range, I wore a medium-sized K-bar knife and an old leather sheath. While I unlocked the gate and got set up, an eagle screamed overhead and several deer came up to the fence to watch. After I had shot 3 rounds, a truck pulled up and parked next to my vehicle. A pretty woman hopped out and the first thing I noticed was that she wore a knife. The second thing I noticed was that she seemed vaguely familiar. She produced a .22 and a deer rifle. I stopped for a drink of soda while she set up some balloon targets at 25 and 50 yards. Soon, she was blasting away. When she stopped to reload, we spoke. I mentioned that I was a mailman from Vancouver and had bought a place nearby. She grinned and said her dad had been a Vancouver letter carrier. I asked his name, expecting to draw a blank. She told me the name and we both smiled. I had known the man 30 years prior when she was probably still in early elementary school. He was a great guy and mentored me at my first postal station. The young lady had bagged her first deer a few days prior and had started to have recurring visions of a big buck when she fell asleep. I had one vision of a doe, which I later saw about 50 kilometers from where we were shooting. I had learned that it is not polite to ask where a person had taken their game. I mentioned this to the lady. She grinned and told me she had bagged hers up on Secret Mountain. The Metis explained to me later that the woods were a big larder for some people, and hence they were reluctant to tell you where their own personal meat locker was. I understood this, and I quit asking people. I also learned not to listen to this type of information when it was freely offered. The Metis was canny in this regards, and by using the free information we two had gleaned that week, he sent me off one day to scout in the opposite direction. We planned to go hunting in a few weeks' time. I went the way he directed and found a plethora of tracks. Big tracks, little tracks, lots of tracks of all sizes. Then I saw all the droppings, massive and fresh as a daisy. It was right near a forestry campsite, and I hurried back to give the news and congratulate my teacher on being so wise. I was asked about the size, shape, and color of the scat. He determined that it had to be moose sign. When I got back to Vancouver, I learned that a plan had been previously set by the Metis to have my wife cook a turkey which he would provide. His woman had called while I was away and had given all the instructions. We two couples were to eat it at my place on the eve of the upcoming hunt. He hadn't asked anyone but had planned it down to the last detail. I was to drive his woman north as well. She still lived in her own place in the Lower Mainland while he pined away alone up in the little town. She visited up there and he visited down to her. I was to give her a ride up for this meal and was even told an alternate route to use to save the bridge toll. I used the alternate route and I got a speeding ticket. During the drive, she complained to the man for 5 long hours. My irritation was offset by my anticipation of filling the freezer with fresh game. After the feast, I was washing up the dishes. My sink clogged. The previous time the Metis had been in my house, my hot water tank had stopped working. Now, I was stuck with a prodigious pile of greasy dishes in bear country. My wife and his woman were going back to Vancouver. We men were leaving to occupy a camping site we had previously scouted. I poured various products down the ABS pipes and nothing happened. I gathered up all the gear I had acquired over the previous year and got my Suzuki ready to roll. I met my teacher at his house and we convoyed out. The route we took was along the Lost River, 3/4 of the way to Secret Mountain, over by Lake St. Nowhere. We gathered some wood left by other hunters who had gone home, and after a few last-minute changes, we settled on a campsite. My education in sawing logs, splitting logs, and quartering split logs was begun. I helped my maestro set up his canvas tent. I learned which types of wood were good and which types were not. I split logs till I broke the head off the old maul which had belonged to my friend's deceased father. It turned out that my new friend had a very restricted diet due to a debilitating bowel disease. He hadn't worked for years. We hadn't conferred with each other as to provisions. I prepared on the basis of feeding myself for the short duration and had assumed that a man with a special diet would do the same. I was quickly lectured by a man my junior on the importance of the sharing way. Everything my mentor shared was busted, rusted, or not to be trusted. Everything I shared was new or in good repair. My food he would not touch save the turkey and my oatmeal. He had a case of no-name vegetable soup which he freely shared. We were at 5,000 feet and the ambient temperature was -3 Celsius. We ate turkey sandwiches for dinner with vegetable soup. In the mornings we had coffee and oatmeal. I found myself devouring my Landjagers on the sly after the second day. On the third day I was nibbling the stick of butter I'd brought. The deceased father of my mentor was always with us. The woodsman measured everything with the precision of an aircraft technician. He had a grip bag of medications and plenty of toilet paper. I had assumed we would sleep in the tent, and I was told that we would take turns. One in the tent and one in my car. I refused to ask for what should be offered, so I decided to sleep on the ground outside. I put down my air mattress and mummy bag right next to the fire. I was instructed to keep my rifle nearby with the clip in and the bolt open. After a scare with pit lampers in his past, my teacher refused to camp without a weapon within easy reach. I placed my Tico beside me in its frosty case as the fire glowed out and the stars blazed. Things went well until a little vole decided to chew a buckskin lace I had tied around my wrist. It was to be used when gutting the deer I was intending to shoot. The voracious little creature went through the leather in a few nibbles and decided it would like a little salt off my arm as well. I slapped it over towards the picnic table. The next morning, all my packaged noodles had been ruined by the spurned rodent. I was off scouting deer beds when the government officials came. I could see the Metis showing his license to a young man and a woman in a uniform. As I approached, I could also see that he was very upset by their intrusion. I walked up and shook hands with the male officer. "I wanted to meet the man who slept out here," he said. "How'd it go?" "Good, until the voles started chewing on me. Also, I discovered why they call them mummy bags. Warm, but you can't turn around and move if you have to without taking the whole shebang with you. I think I'll be swapping that bag next year." "I hear you. I hate 'em too. Can I see your rifle?" "Yes, sir." I took the weapon from its frosty case and handed it over after doing the procedure I had learned in school to prove it safe. The man hefted the weapon and admired it. "That's a beautiful rifle. I wish I had one like that. Did you put that eagle feather on it?" "Yes, sir. That's not a decoration. If it's pointing at me, my quarry cannot smell me. If it's pointing at my quarry, I'm going hungry. If it swings out right or left, I need to adjust for windage. I chose that rifle because I waited 56 years, and this is the one that I'll be handing down to my son. I'm part Swedish, and I know that the next best metallurgist in the world after the Swedes are the Finns. That's a Finnish cold-rolled stainless steel barrel, and that's why I bought it. Have you ever hunted deer before? No, sir. It's my first time. This fellow is a long-time hunter of deer and moose and is showing me the ropes a bit. Well, I wish you lots of luck. A deer is an amazingly smart animal. Don't get discouraged. It'll come. When you're walking the roads and looking into the brush, look twice or three times, even if you've already scanned that area. All you might get is a tiny flicker of an ear before your brain can furnish up the rest of the picture. So well do they hide. We walked the roads dawn and dusk for a week. We saw tracks, beds, scat, and chewed vegetation. The only deer I had seen recently was in town at the range and on the way up to the campsite in an area off limits to hunting. That one turned out to be the doe in my dream. It stood a few feet away from my vehicle and stared at me for 4 minutes before slowly walking into the pines. On the second night, I slept fitfully in my car due to lack of leg room. On the third night, I was invited into the tent. There was just enough room for the two of us and my rifle. My mate murmured, snored, and gibbered most of the night. He did get up first and cook the oatmeal, however. Camp chores and incessant talk of God took the place of deer hunting education. Soon, I was ready to pull 3 nails from the meat pole, drive up the highway, and give the Korean lady at the motel a hammer and ask her if she could put me up for the night. I informed the metis that if he had any ideas of me or my wife joining his church, he could forget it. This clearly angered him, but he fought it down. On the last day, I saw a fresh moose track broken through the surface ice of a puddle. We followed along this track to a swamp. We had located the wintering grounds. Not far away was a creek which spilled down from a lake a few hundred feet above, and I was told that this was probably the summering place. We both got excited and decided to return next season. During all these dawn and dusk patrols, I'd been cautioned not to smoke until back at camp. It was the scent, you know. On the last of these slow walks, I was 50 yards in front. I heard a horrible retching sound. It was semi-human, and I spun around. There, silhouetted against the old-growth firs, was my mentor bent over with his pants to his ankles. A stream of waste arced out into the moose habitat on the downslope side of the road. I turned around and stood guard for my stricken friend. When the noises ceased, I began to slowly walk until I heard that sound again. I felt sorry for the man, but I laughed at the ridiculousness of our situation. I lit a smoke. Hopefully it would help the sensitive nose of the moose from being overwhelmed by the human stench. Might bring in a grizzly, though, thinking that something big had died there. We packed up, and I was instructed to meet at a gas station in town so I could pay my half of the gas, although we had each brought a vehicle and had also used mine for 2 scouting trips. I was further instructed to help him set up his trailer hitch onto a new pine stump back at his house. As we packed up, I commented on our fireside chats and expressed my hope that I hadn't verbalized overly much. "I tell you, Michael, I only take in 25% of what you say. It's from all the drinking and drugs." I drove behind him to help if he got stuck until we got on a safe road. On the return journey, we stopped at the tracks I had scouted a week prior. I now learned that they were cow tracks. There were free-ranging bovines in the canyon. I had driven over the cattle guard on my way up, dreaming of a buck. I was embarrassed, but it had been 40 years since I'd even seen a cow track. After we were on asphalt, I pulled over for a smoke. After having walked 1 mile in his moccasins, I knew that I would have to tell him and his fiancée adios. I went to his house and helped with his trailer, and I paid him the gas money. I went home and worked on the clogged sink for the balance of the afternoon. A large bottle of hydrochloric acid gel, a funnel, a turkey baster, some safety goggles, and a flashlight were the only tools required to clear the blockage. I returned to Vancouver and my busy life. He said something to his fiancée during a quarrel within a week of my return. She repeated it to my wife in the post-quarrel phone call. It was untrue, but it had my name on it. That night, I wrote letters to this pair of misfits which informed them that they were both no longer welcome at my house or on my phone. I would return the things given to me. I would not associate with either of them. I was already gone. I had a chore to do. I researched the founders of his sect. A young woman who had been struck in the face by a rock as a child had begun to have visions. She married a man who followed one of the various new sects spewing out of rural New York State in the mid-1800s. It was distinguished by the precise prediction of the end of the world, the keeping of the Sabbath, the setting of the creation date at 6,000 years ago precisely, and a belief in something called soul sleep. The date for the predicted end came and went, and the new adherents left in droves. The man and his teenage wife broke away and decided to start their own branch of the sect. They changed the date based on a different approach to interpreting the scripture. That date came and went. These complications always arise when men try to decode the scripture. Only the author knows the code. Amazingly, with time and much technique, the pool of believers increased instead of decreased, and today it has millions of members worldwide. The woman wrote many a book and lived for a while in Australia. I deduce that these people may not easily be dissuaded. A few weeks after I sent the letters, I was up country unloading some furniture. The Metis appeared in the drive and came up the steps to the porch. He had his letter in his hand. I came out onto the porch and did not invite him in. He handed back the letter and informed me that he did not accept it. I opened it and read it aloud to him, and I asked him which part he did not understand. I pointed out that there was nothing in the letter that was optional. He said that he thought I was just scared of Jesus. I was scared of changing. I told him that I and my wife would no longer associate with him nor his fiancée. He began to talk of the latest things that God had told him concerning his affair with this unhappy woman, and I cut him off and reminded him that I no longer cared to be kept advised. He shook my hand for too long to be comfortable and gave me a religious tract. I asked him if he wished to have back his deceased father's fishing pole. He said no. He was certain I'd come around to being his friend again. I said goodbye. He said his door was always open. I said goodbye. He said that it wasn't just him praying for me, that there was a whole lot of people praying for me. I said goodbye. He waddled off to his truck and sat a while praying hard before driving off. I gathered up the religious tract, the fishing pole, the vest, and the coat rack by the door. I swore like a stevedore on the Lisbon docks. I smudged the whole place with sage. Things seemed to always break or malfunction whenever he or his woman were around. The next morning I dropped off all the gear to his front porch with a clearly written note saying not to return them.
You, why don't you do right like some other men do?
I'm Michael Hawes, and you're listening to My Time as a Banker. You cannot touch the principal. When I was just 20, I met a gal by chance down in North Las Vegas while attending a Texas friend's wedding. I had been summoned to play guitar at his reception. She was pretty, jolly, and played guitar too. I heard her sing by chance, and she had the voice of an angel. Her songs were all her own compositions, and her rhythmic strumming combined with her haunting sweet voice wove a bind rune around my young heart. Her father was a retired colonel who managed the department of the MGM Grand Hotel. I didn't much like hotels or motels, and my first paying job as a child had been cleaning display houses, so it really didn't impress me much. Her mother was a secretary of the law firm of Jack Lehman, Esquire. That name meant nothing to me at the time. They had a horse in their backyard, but the backyard was desert as far as one could see all the way to Sunrise Mountain. None of that stuff impressed me too much, but I was sure stuck on that blue-eyed, blonde-haired gal. Her elder brother tried to scare me with high-speed night driving on a long washboard road into the city. The caddy got big air on each bump and the shocks began to bottom out. Like the character Dwayne in one of Woody Allen's movies, he asked if I had ever felt like just ending it all and driving into an oncoming car. I told him no, but that there were plenty of other people out there who did. I didn't tell him that my father used to suddenly swerve into the wrong lane, smash the dashboard, hit the brakes, and shriek, "Christ, we're gonna hit!" during our obligatory Sunday drives. Big Brother couldn't find my scary button, and he got flustered when he'd exhausted his entire repertoire. We were out of the desert and coming into the city lights. He wound up nearly losing control and scared himself when he knocked over a traffic sign. The caddy got hung up and a crowd of young Vegas street urchins came out of the neon night and rocked the big green boat off the bent metal before the cops could arrive. I just held the girl's hand, who was genuinely scared, and suggested that he take us home. I'm pretty sure he reported to his daddy that I had kept my cool. The girl had been born in California, and I decided to just overlook that. But she had lived most of her childhood in Panama. I had two Colombian-born half-sisters I'd never met, so I scored that jungle time in her favor. One day, during the week I first met her, we were sitting at a Taco Bell in her father's caddy, and she said we ought to get married. I hadn't even kissed her yet, except in my mind, and I immediately said, "Why not?" I drove her home and made the announcement to her folks and her siblings. A carton of Marlboros later, the colonel put an end to the questions that I'd been fielding from his family. I vowed I would go to Canada, get a job for $800 a month at a restaurant I knew, rent an apartment, and send a one-way ticket to their 18-year-old daughter ASAP. We shook on it, and next morning I was off to McCarran International, early in the morning. My plan went almost as outlined above, and I sent a ticket to the gal. She arrived with only a guitar and a Navajo blanket. I got a second job so I could get out of my stepfather's extra bedroom sooner than later. The immigration officials had told me that I would have to marry her within 6 months or she'd be deported. I rented a nice flat in Deep Cove with a view of Panorama Park. I made wedding rings from some big hex nuts which I ground smooth and filed the threads off of and four of the points off. I later had custom gold rings made to my own design by my new sister-in-law, who was a budding jeweler. On a lunch break from my cooking job, I got married by a justice of the peace on Lonsdale Avenue. It cost $10 with the single photo. I went back to work, and the gal went to my stepfather's place to share the news. The Dane got her rip-roaring drunk, and she was sick all over me and the taxi on our way home to the apartment that wedding night. It was nothing like the movies. During our brief marriage of 30 months, we had many trials. My father committed suicide, her sister was killed in a motorcycle accident, and we lived in a haunted house. I went through a dozen jobs and we moved many times. We hitchhiked across Guatemala for our honeymoon. My mother left the Dane, and her and my sister came to stay with me. My mother went back to the Dane, and my new wife let my sister stay. I brought my sister back to her mother. I prayed she would understand why someday. I was having trouble finding career-type employment, and my wife wasn't allowed to work due to immigration rules in force at that time. Eventually, I got hired as a manager trainee for a big bank. I put my pipe threader in storage and dressed up, cut off my hair. This was coming along fine, and we got a nice basement suite in Lynn Valley, way up Mountain Highway on Kilmer Road. The owners and landlords were newly arrived Scots with a bright baby boy, and I loved living there. Then it happened one Saturday. For the second time in my life up to that point, I made an unwelcome discovery while perusing some poetry and lyrics. I became slightly rightly suspicious of my little wife. And a short time later, I stumbled on damning evidence of a broken vow and confronted the girl. She didn't deny my allegations and confessed to cheating with another man. You can't glue a vow back together, but the Irishman and me decided to give her one chance more, due to her young age. I asked my wife if she loved me or him. While she cogitated on this, the Cherokee in me told her the answer had to be one or the other. She replied that she wanted time to ponder the answer. The Welshman in me asked her how much time. She said about a month, and that she would like to go live at his place while she pondered it. The German in me told her she could have 15 minutes starting now, and the Swede in me began packing her suitcase. The phone rang. It was her mother calling from Vegas. "Michael, I have wonderful news. You better sit down. Do you have a pen and paper?" "Yes, ma'am." "Well, I'll be brief. My husband and I have just concluded some investment deals and had a windfall. You're about to move up quite a few notches in your position in the bank. I've already spoken to your bank manager there in Vancouver. You'll be in charge of doing some financial transactions for some people down here on a regular basis. We have opened up trust accounts for you two as well as all our other children. Each of you will have $1 million. You cannot touch the principal, but the interest is yours to do as you see fit. Now first, give me a name for your trust." "Cedar" was all I could think of. "Fine, Cedar it is. Now write this down. Mr. A and Mr. B will arrive Monday on Flight C at D o'clock, and you are to pick them up and take them to your bank. They will have all the necessary papers for you to sign, as well as instructions for you and your manager at the bank." As she spoke, I was doodling on a piece of paper where I had written the information. The interest at that time for savings account was over 9%, and the monthly take of interest was over $7,000. I was making about $700 a month as a trainee at the time. A spiritual owl swooped down and snatched that part of my brain full of ideas which had no means to see them realized, shot up through the Van Allen belt, and kept on going. Cocaine is but a raggedy, feeble, distant cousin to this feeling. I began to drip water from my armpits. I was visibly shaken after being emotionally stirred. I could hear my wife sniffling in the bedroom. "Mom," I said flatly. "Yes, honey. Not a bad day, huh? Take a deep breath. It's all real." "Mom, there's something I think I need to tell you." "Sure, honey. What is it?" "It's about your daughter." "What about my baby girl?" "Mom, I think she's going to leave me and that we're going to split up. Does that change all the things you just told me?" "Michael, Michael, you are honest to a fault. It certainly does change everything. Put her on the phone." I called my wife to the phone. She hadn't given me her answer yet, and as I watched her face, I saw the sliver of a chance that we might have had to remain together disappear quick time. My owl of dreams and ideas did an abrupt bout face and re-entered the atmosphere of my situation. It was like falling asleep on warm sand and waking up on a sheet of sea ice. I staggered out the door mumbling to myself and went with gravity until I reached the intersection of Lynn Valley Road and Mountain Highway, where there was a service station. A mechanic had noticed my erratic walking style and rushed out from his service bay. He grabbed my arm and towed me into the shop. He sat a bucket upside down and made me sit. He yelled at another mechanic to get a mug of coffee. I took the offered drink and muttered something about losing a wife and $1 million at the same time and all before lunch. "Talk," he said. I reiterated that morning's events and my mother-in-law's call. "Sweet and holy fook," said one mechanic. "She sure pissed on your cornflakes," said the other. I wound my way back uphill after thanking the fellas. When I arrived, my gal was gone with the suitcase and instructions. 3 days later, I woke to the sound of my Scottish landlady's voice. She was tugging something out of my grip.
"Michael, I'll pick ye, lad. She'll nae be back. Look, man, you have nae left off clutching her shirt since Sunday, as if she's died. Fling it away. She's only a wee gal. You'll soon find another. Dinna worry, eh? I made you a posh bricky aloft, and I told the bank to give you another day's grace before you show up."
I was told 3 years later by my ex-mother-in-law, when I was signing the divorce papers, that there had been no fortune. She said her and the colonel had been conned by some pros and had lost everything.
Get out of here.